Good evening, everyone. You're in the right place at the right time. This is Coast to Coast AM, blasting out of the Mojave Desert like a Scirocco blazing across the land, into your town, into your home, slamming into your radio like a supercharged nanoparticle of dark energy, squeezing your brain, messing with your mind, and just maybe challenging your grip on that amorphous and elusive concept known as reality. Greetings from the boldest, bawdiest, most outrageous city in the world, the planetary capital of sun, fun, sin, sex, and secrets, my not-so-humble hometown, Las Vegas, Nevada. My name is George Knapp. I'm your host, your trail guide, your designated driver of the airwaves, at least for the next few hours. A pleasant Memorial Day weekend to all of you and your families. And now, look, I don't want to hear any of this stuff about how you have to go to bed, you have to get some shut-eye, you have to get your beauty sleep. You're beautiful enough. It's a holiday tomorrow. No one except the truck drivers out there have to go to work. You got no excuse. You can stay up late with us, have some fun, learn a few things. We've got some great stuff coming your way over the next 4 hours. Here's basically the roadmap in this first hour. We'll chat about some things underway in the world around us, including that landing on Mars, for one thing. I might even talk about some wild horses and wild cows, and I'm not making that one up either. Got a few blasts from the past about some UFO information from years gone by that really hits home today. And also in this hour, I'll be joined by one of the all-time great UFO investigators. He was a colleague and contemporary of the great Dr. J. Allen Hynek. Probably knows more about physical evidence left behind by UFOs than any person in the world. But he's not all that well known to the general public. I think probably because he works on pursuing the evidence rather than writing books and making speeches. His name is Ted Phillips, and he'll be making his second ever appearance on Coast to Coast tonight. I spoke to him by phone earlier this evening. I know he's raring to go with some new information about some exciting new projects he's working on. And then in the second hour, our guest will be Nick Pope. He is the man who headed up the UFO study by the British Ministry of Defense. He's a best-selling author, an excellent speaker, a good guy. And in light of the release of the so-called British X-Files last week, Nick Pope's a guy who might have a couple of things to say about what he says he saw when he worked back in that sensitive position. So when I tell you we've got some good stuff on tap, I'm not exaggerating. A couple things you probably didn't see in your hometown newspaper today. When I tell you there's no news town in the world like Las Vegas, I'm not kidding. Our governor, his name is Jim Gibbons, he popped over to Iraq this past week to visit the troops and to boost morale. And I think it was really his morale that needed boosting. Turns out the governor is going through a nasty divorce. He's been in office for about 18 months now. It's been one scandal after another. And the one person who stood by him is his wife. And now he's dumping her. And there are rumblings that the governor's got something going on the side, a little romance with a woman who is herself married. That's not the kind of story I would normally cover. I'm not even sure it's newsworthy in and of itself, except Nevada's first lady, the jilted spouse, is not going quietly. And it's a regular Peyton place here. She's refused to move out of the governor's mansion. Says she has her first lady duties to attend to, and basically, she's putting the squeeze on her hubby. You know, he's been staying at their home in Reno, waiting until this would blow over, until someone found this old law which said the governor has to live, by law, in the governor's mansion. So it's quite a little spectacle, and I'll bet my governor is more scandalous than your governor, except maybe if you live in New Jersey. And a couple of days ago, one of our state lawmakers made a big news splash herself. Her name is Frances Allen. She was in the news a few weeks ago because she got married, but she essentially stiffed this little mom-and-pop flower company that provided flowers for her wedding. She paid them about a tenth of what she'd agreed to pay. Figured she could get away with because of her office. And maybe that was an omen, a bad karma omen for her marriage, because last weekend, the newlywed couple, this Frances Allen and her husband, had some friends over their house. They slammed a couple of drinks, and then after the company left, she got real mad at them. It's around midnight. The assemblywoman stabbed a butcher knife into her new husband's arm. Wham! Stabbed him. He drove himself to the hospital, told the police what had happened. They went and arrested her. Then her husband said, well, I'm going to change my story. I don't want her to go to jail. So now he says he stabbed himself. So I tell you, man, I love this town. I mean it. I love this town. You probably also saw the stories about Charles Barkley and NFL troublemaker Pac-Man Jones. Both had arrest warrants issued this week by our district attorney because they didn't pay their gambling debts. Used to be in the old days, if you didn't pay your debts to a Las Vegas casino, they'd send a couple of guys with no necks to come after you. Now they send the DA, who maybe is almost as ferocious as those guys, who may or may not still be around. If you skip out on a casino marker, it's like the same as writing a bad check, so it's illegal and they'll come after you. No news town like Las Vegas. You know, Memorial Day tomorrow is such a thoughtful holiday. I mean, it's our most thoughtful holiday, and to honor those who've fallen in battle to protect our freedoms. And of course, this year we have many more who've fallen. And I don't want to get into the whole question of whether this war in Iraq is a good idea or a bad idea or a grab for oil or a necessary evil. As a country, you know, we've talked that one to death. But I would say that since our nation and our leaders say to us over and over how much they love our troops, how much we should support the troops, how we should never criticize what goes on over there because it's an insult to our troops. So one thing all these politicians agree on, support the troops, but support them how? On this Memorial Day, I hope the answer is show them we appreciate what they're doing for this with more than just words. You can't send men and women over there to die for us and increase the length and number of their tours of duty and then cut their benefits, cut what we provide to their families who are waiting for them here at home, cut their housing benefits, oppose their modest pay increases, cut their medical benefits, the very things that have been done over the past couple of years. I read this report. It was aired, I think, over the weekend by CBS. It's an analysis of suicide rates among veterans. Very disturbing, especially for these new young veterans, the veterans of this war. The suicide rate for these guys is about four times the rate for civilians in their same age group. And they had this University of Georgia scientists analyzing the epidemiology information. And I'll tell you, it's enough to, I don't mean to cast a pall over your Memorial Day holiday. Enjoy your day, enjoy your freedoms, but if you want to honor those who defend those freedoms with their lives, hope you do it with more than words. And that goes for the president and for Congress and for the public. You know, I mentioned to you last week my friend Ray Slaughter, who worked for years at the Nevada test site in the atomic weapons program. He got exposed to a lot of radiation. Now he's dying. You all sent him some positive vibes last week, and Ray says he feels better, even though he knows his time is running out. Ray and thousands of his coworkers were promised by our government that they'd be cared for and compensated and treated for their illnesses. And the government's dragged its feet. It's reneged on that promise every chance it gets. And hundreds of these guys have died while waiting for the promises to be kept. And it turns out the same is true at the infamous Area 51 military base here in Nevada. You know, the morning after we discussed that last week on the air, the local newspaper carried a story about this guy at Area 51. He's retired. His name is Fred Dunham. Like a lot of his coworkers out there, he's seriously ill now because of this toxic crap he breathed out there during those years that the base, they wouldn't let anything leave Area 51, so they'd burn it all in open pits. Toxic, composite, secret stuff, doused in jet fuel, they all breathed it. A lot of them got sick, and now they're getting the runaround. You know, loyal Americans kept their mouths shut, lived up to their security oaths, did their duty. It's not a tough call. You know, what kind of a country we're having here? Someone who lives and up to their end of the deal, a soldier, a Cold War vet like Fred, should get what's coming to them, what we've promised them, without the runaround, without the red tape, and without a waiting game designed to make them die before the bureaucrats do their job. Again, didn't mean to put a pall on your hotel, but it is, I mean, on your holiday, but it is, you know, it is Memorial Day. It is time to think about this kind of stuff. And so I wanted to get that off my chest. We're going to take a short break here for a moment, and then we will come back. We'll talk a little bit about Willie Nelson and Snoop Dogg, and we'll introduce you to Ted Phillips. So stick around on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back, everyone. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm George Knapp. Congratulations to NASA for the successful landing today of that Phoenix probe, the robotic device that touched down on Mars today. And Phoenix, if you've been reading this in the paper, Phoenix is going to stay basically in one spot up there near the polar region of Mars. And one of its primary missions will be to figure out if Mars could have sustained life. And what are the clues to show how habitable the planet might have been in the past and how habitable it might be right now? And maybe I've got this wrong and I'm just reading too much into it. But my understanding is Phoenix will actually not be searching for life itself or evidence of ancient life. It's going to analyze the conditions for life, but not look for life itself. And if that's the case, why? I mean, why aren't they up there looking for evidence of life directly and promptly? And I sometimes wonder if the folks at NASA really want the answer. I'm sure there's a lot of them who've worked there their whole lives that really do want to know what's going on out there and whether there's life elsewhere. But couldn't they have included an experiment which would have answered this simple and fundamental and important question instead of merely studying, like, whether the conditions for life are right? Maybe there's a technical reason that I don't understand, that maybe somebody in our audience can explain this to us later in the program. But, you know, after so many probes and so many failures on Mars, I, for one, would like to know the answer, you know, like before I die one of these days. And I'm sure a lot of you feel the same way. Our webmaster, Tim, has some stuff posted on the Coast to Coast site about the Phoenix probe, so you can check it out if you get a chance. Also on the site, an article about crystal skulls. Now, you probably know that crystal skulls play a big role in the new Indiana Jones movie, which has already made a huge pile of money this weekend. The skulls are controversial. Some think that there is a connection to ETs. This article posted on the Coast site asserts that scientists think that two of the best-known skulls are fakes in the sense that they were not made by ancient people, the Incas or whatever. Whoever made them probably used something like a modern grinding device, presumably powered by electricity, to grind down the crystals. And that's good information, but I'm not sure it proves that they're fakes in a strict sense. It might prove they weren't made by Incas, but doesn't prove they're not old, if you catch my meaning. I mean, if you buy the weird mythology surrounding the skulls, maybe they were made with power tools, but it's just a long time ago and by someone else. I'm just saying. I reported to you a couple of months ago about the plight of wild horses here in Nevada. Our state is home to about half of the nation's remaining wild horses, and over the past few years, it seems like the government, the BLM, has made a concerted effort to round up as many of them as it can handle, stick them in pens, doing as little as possible to find them homes, which is required by the law. Not really getting any better. Now the state of Nevada is getting into the act. They're sort of plotting to remove a large herd living in the northern part of our state because these horses are viewed as nuisances. Well, coming to the rescue is an unlikely alliance. A country singer named Lacey J. Dalton from years ago has sort of jumped into the fray in a big way. She set up an organization, and then she called on some of her pals from the music industry to help her, including, I guess, Willie Nelson and Merle Haggard. So now they're on board trying to help, talking about some strange bedfellows, though. Somehow, rapper Snoop Dogg also heard about this, maybe from his kids. So he calls up Lacey J. Dalton to offer his help. Now he and Willie Nelson and Merle Haggard have recorded some messages together. They're making calls, trying to stave off what looks like a planned extinction. And I just think that's such an interesting grouping of entertainers. A side note, as I was working on this wild horse story, I heard something about wild cows. Now, apparently, and I'm not making this up, there are roaming herds of wild cows out in Nevada, and they cause a lot of damage on ranches. They scare the hell out of people. The government's decided to do something about it. Fish and Wildlife came up with a plan to hire these contractors to go out and hunt them down, take them out. And I have this image in my head of these stealthy hunters in camo gear sneaking out into the brush to shoot down the wily, dangerous wild cows of Nevada. You know, I think the plan is on hold now. The government wants individual ranchers to take care of any of these wild cows that they might find, whether that means shooting them or eating them or bringing them into the fold. But I'll keep you posted on this breaking story. I think I told you a couple of programs ago, that I found it useful to go ahead and dig back into the archives for UFO information from the past. And the reason is a lot of the stuff that was written both in books and government documents before the folks who control this information got really good at cover-up stuff is just far better than what we read now. An example of a book that I would consider as good or better than anything that's been printed in the last 10 years is something written by the father of modern ufology. His name is J. Allen Hynek. The book is called The Hynek UFO Report. It is the one that established this classification system that's now known all over the world, Close Encounters, of the first, second, third, and fourth kinds. If you can find a copy of this book, either on the internet or at a used bookstore in your town, it's a great read, as good or better than the very best UFO books you've read from more recent times. It basically distills thousands of reports that were collected by Project Blue Book and drags out the most pertinent information. And contrary to what the Air Force told us back then when it canceled Blue Book, there is solid information in those reports to indicate that something weird and unexplained was going on, something potentially very important. And it's especially relevant for us tonight because Ted Phillips is going to be joining us now. And he is probably the world's foremost authority on close encounters of the second kind, that is, Close encounter is where a craft that is observed and it somehow interacts with the environment. In other words, it leaves some physical evidence. And Ted, are you there?
Yes, hi.
Ted is currently the director of the Center for Physical Trace Research. He's got thousands of these trace cases in his files. He's one of the greats of ufology, and strangely enough, I've never got to meet the guy. Am I embarrassing you yet?
No.
Can you tell us to begin with, Ted, how many do you have in your files now? How many of these cases?
Oh, gosh. The number as of today is 3,389 cases from 92 countries.
And is it, when I say files, is it like files at my house, like it's in a big box of stuff sitting on the floor somewhere, or have you got it organized?
Well, I don't think I'd go as far as organized, but it's kind of like Alan Hynek's files. He had a three-story house, and he liked to tell people about his vertical file system, and that was the three-story staircase in his house, and so it was quite a system. But he actually did have some file cabinets. So
here's why I think of your work as just as important as anything that anyone has ever done in the field, and that is that, you know, mainstream scientists who don't want to take UFOs seriously say, where's the evidence? Why don't we have a cigarette lighter from a UFO? You are dealing with actual physical evidence. Now, you're not saying what UFOs are, they're ETs or whatever, but you've got physical evidence that something really happened at these sites where witnesses say something landed, right?
Yes. In 1968, as a matter of fact, Alan Hynek suggested that I should specialize in these types of cases. And so I started digging back through old UFO reports, and I remember the first lecture I gave was at the first MUFON conference, and had 157 cases, and everyone thought that was astonishing. And here we sat with over 3,000, and the 3,389 cases have been culled out of a much larger catalog, because I took out all of the cases that did not have an observed object generating the traces. In other words, it would be an odd area found similar to what would be generated by an observed object, and but nothing was seen doing the work. And so I removed all those and dropped it from about just over 5,000 to this figure. And these are really the very best cases. And what I think is makes trace cases such quality cases. For example, over 45% of these reports involve two or more witnesses, and in many cases, several witnesses. And in these cases, we're not talking about a light in the night sky that could be anything, but rather an object seen less than 45 feet from the witnesses in nearly 50% of the reports. The object is seen for, in many, many instances, 20, 30 minutes to an hour, and that's plenty of time to determine if it's a Goodyear blimp sitting on the ground somewhere. And the things are seen under good seeing conditions with landmarks observed between the witnesses and the object and around the object and behind it. A lot of reference points to be sure that the effects found on the ground or in the trees or whatever were actually generated by that object. And what's kind of interesting is that 20.7% of these 3,389 involve humanoid sightings. And for the past 10 years, that's been dropping. 10 years ago, that number was 24.4%. So it's fallen about 4% with fewer cases involving little guys.
Tell me this, is it a prerequisite that you have a witness? I mean, is it you have to have a witness who saw something on the ground as opposed to you going out and finding a burn spot in the ground somewhere?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And 20% of them say they see humanoids, and we're not talking about humanoids, I presume.
Yes. Yeah. Over 95% of the humanoid cases involved in these landings are described as typically the 3 to 3.5 foot high.
Ted, hold that thought. We need to take a short break. We'll be right back with Ted Phillips talking about close encounters of the second kind. Stick around for Coast to Coast AM. Here on Coast to Coast, we're talking about UFOs with the great Ted Phillips. And when we say UFOs and UFO evidence, we're not talking about elusive lights in the sky. Ted is a hands-on researcher and investigator who's been to 90 countries around the world investigating landing site trace cases, where he comes back with physical evidence that can be analyzed by scientists, assuming those scientists had the guts to take a look at the evidence in the first place, which is something we're going to get into with Ted when we come back right after this short break. Stick around, everyone, on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. We're speaking with Ted Phillips, the director of the Center for Physical Trace Research. Ted, give us the laundry list of the kinds of physical evidence that you've acquired at these UFO or alleged UFO landing sites.
Well, I think the most significant type of physical trace was found, one of the very best examples was at a landing in just outside a small town in central Kansas. And very briefly, the object was seen hovering about 5 feet above the ground. And the surface of this thing was just totally awash with brilliant multicolored light, and at the base of it there was a aqueous material dropping, floating toward the ground in a kind of circular pattern.
Is this the Delphos case?
Yes, the Delphos. And the this aqueous appearing material was luminous, a very bright glow, and as the base of the object was about 5 feet above the ground, this sort of steam that was coming down ended about 1 foot above the ground surface. And so there was a gap there, and on the surface of the soil beneath this area, the witness saw a haze or fog developing in a donut shape, a circular shape. And after the object ascended, and there were physical effects on the witness, animal effects, a lot of things too detailed to get into, but after the object had left, he saw it flying away to the south, ran into the house, told his parents. They came out. They also saw the object. It was seen by other witnesses also. And after he had described that this thing had been hovering there for several minutes out behind a hog shed, he and his parents run out into this really dark area, and there they find an 8-foot donut of very luminous material. And the mother and father leaned down and rubbed their fingers on the surface of the ring, and instantly they both experienced a numbing of the fingers. And this effect lasted in Mrs. Johnson for about 3 weeks and in Mr. Johnson for about 2 to 3 days. And I know of other people, including a well-known scientist, who not only experienced a numbing of the fingers, but in running to the farmhouse to wash up, it was in August, it was very hot, and he's perspiring, and the sweat is running into his eyes, and he rubbed his hand over his forehead and eyes, and that entire area went numb, and he became quite frightened. So it has been experienced by a number of people.
How quickly was your team or the team of investigators able to get to that Delphos site after this thing was seen?
Well, unfortunately, George, back in those days, it was a very typical situation in that the witnesses finally reported to the sheriff. The sheriff filed a report. The Salina, Kansas newspaper found out about it. They went out, interviewed the witnesses. The article appeared a couple of days later, and a lady in Salina sent a copy of the article to a friend in Ohio who was a friend of Alan Hynek's. And so a month after it happened, we learned of the case. And that's unfortunate because this ring remained luminous for four evenings following the event. And then the luminosity faded. And the soil was already returning somewhat to its original state by the time I got there 4 weeks after the fact.
What was left to analyze?
Well, lots, really. This 8-foot ring, and again, I called it a donut because the central soil was unaffected. And when I arrived there early in the morning, there had been a snow the evening before, and the entire farm lot was just a bog. I mean, just mud and water. And the ring surface was perfectly outlined with unmelted snow. And this was the only unmelted snow on the entire place. And as I would skiff off the snow, directly beneath it was a very light brown and totally dry soil. And this is found only in the ring material. And this effect went 14 inches down into the ground where it ended abruptly. And the soil was completely dehydrated, totally sapped in moisture, and would not absorb a drop of moisture.
Any radioactivity?
No. No radiation, no magnetic effects.
Have you ever found radiation at one of these sites?
Not very often. In all of these cases, actually less than 1% of them have produced any recordable radiation effects. So it's just not often found.
Well, give me the laundry list of the kinds of stuff that you've collected from, and I'm assuming there was none of that numbing material that was left to analyze, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah. As a matter of fact, I brought home the first trip about 40 pounds. And
what is it?
Well, what it is, it's normal Kansas soil that has been coated by something that we couldn't get identified. And we sent samples to absolutely every laboratory that would even take them. And ironically, the laboratory that did the most work on this stuff was Oak Ridge. And the project director, the director of the Orion Project there, was a good friend of Alan's. And they were doing really serious analysis of this stuff, and they sent us some electronic microscopic images that showed the coating material on tiny pieces of the soil. And then they had some higher magnification images that showed tiny, tiny crystal-like structures in this coating material. And no one at Oak Ridge could identify it. No one there had ever seen anything like it before. And suddenly, as it was getting really interesting, Alan and I both received letters from the director simply stating that due to a change in management, they could no longer work with the material.
Due to a change in management, when they found out the previous manager had been working with you and cooperating.
Yeah.
Ted, give me the laundry list, though, of the kinds of things that you've brought back from these sites. I mean, you've got that strange soil that you found there, baked soil, right?
Oh, yeah.
Other places?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, the three primary types of traces would be the site would be dehydrated, would be burnt or scorched, and typically not by a flame sort of heat, but rather just air-generated heat like you would get from a microwave, for example. And a lot of the effects on the plants and the soil and on witnesses conform to microwave-type energy. And that's something we'd find over and over. And the third primary type would be simply depressed, where a large, circular, and very heavy object had rested on the vegetation or the soil.
And sometimes you can figure out, calculate what it weighed?
Yes. As a matter of fact, the best way, two of the types of objects that typically generate traces have either three landing legs or four. For example, a squirrel type objects have four. The classic saucers land on a tripod configuration. And in those imprints, it's possible to take compaction tests on each imprint and determine through calculations the weight of the object imprinted on the ground. And in all the cases that I worked, the numbers would be, depending on the type of object, anywhere from 7 to 14 tons. So that's a real physical object with mass.
You've heard it 100 times, maybe 1,000 times, from scientists, debunkers, the folks who are professionals who don't want to take this seriously, who will say, look, we can't study this stuff. There's nothing to study. And yet you've got lots of stuff to study, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. A lot of casts of the imprints, and the imprints themselves are made by, without any question, constructed structured devices. With absolute form, and the distribution of the imprints in a number of cases indicated a fairly complex landing system that keeps the object perfectly horizontal in relation to the terrain.
So, I mean, you look at this evidence, you can say something really did land there. The witnesses were accurate in their description that something really did land, and there is physical evidence that something landed, but you don't take it to the next step and say it's from somewhere else.
Well, what I like to say is that based on the facts, what we're looking at devices that have been constructed and are under some sort of intelligent control. Now, from where or how, I wouldn't have a clue.
What do you get what do you say when people say, well, look, you know, you don't have a piece of a craft. Why don't you have a piece of a craft? Where's the cigarette lighter? Where's the tire or something like that?
Yeah, well, you typically, for example, if an F-18 landed in a field, you wouldn't expect to find a tire. And I do keep hoping to find, like, some oil droppings or some other sort of droppings. But to date, I haven't. There is in Slovakia a site where in 1663, a large circular device crashed into one of the mountains in the High Tatras. And some of the villagers eventually went up there and brought pieces of this thing back. And they a great sickness hit the people in the village, and they were dying as their hair fell out and their hair turned gray and they had great blisters on their skin. And you know what that sounds like. And
yeah,
they buried the pieces of this device outside the village. And I know precisely where this village is, so on our next trip over there, that's on my laundry list.
Well, hold on here a second. Your next trip over. So this is one of the projects you're working on now through your Center for Physical Trace Research, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So it's what we call Project Moonshaft. And real quickly, in 1944, during World War II, a Czech engineer who was captain in the Slavic Underground Army, his battalion was wiped out with the exception of he and two of his men, and they were all wounded. And they were at the north slopes of the High Tatra Mountains in northern Slovakia. And they were left for dead by the Germans. And a Slavic farmer found them and treated their wounds and built a stretcher, and took them 4 hours hiking up into the high mountains to a small opening to a much larger cave. And the cave is huge, and it's a very complex cavern. And the Slavic gentleman asked Dr. Hurok, who was the Czech engineer, to please not go back in his cave because there was dangerous gas, bottomless pits, and it was surely haunted. And then he performed the holy rites over himself, over the men, and over the cave, and especially over a passageway that continued on back. And so as soon as Slavik left the cave, which the entrance he had always concealed with stones, and as soon as he left, Hurok shouldered his rifle and carbide light and some ropes and went back into the cave, primarily because he hadn't eaten for 4 days, and he suspected he might find some bats. And after traveling just about 2 miles back into this cavern, he came upon a long, level corridor. And at the end of this corridor was a crawlway. And as he crawled through it, it opens up into a very large room. And across the room, he could see a large expanse of a shiny black material. And this black material was framed by stalactites, flowstone, limestone formations, which had adhered to the outer surface of this wall. And there was a crack running down the front of the wall, and at the point where the crack reached the floor of the cavern, it looked large enough for Tony to wriggle through it. And his diary, which is on the website, he maintained all through World War II. And it's the most fascinating description of his entry into this thing and the cave itself and so on. And as he finally managed to wriggle through this, he could see that this was the outer wall of a huge structure, and the wall was 7 feet thick. And as he got through it, he rolled down an incline of limestone deposit until he hit the back wall of this structure. And he got his carbide light going, and this place was like an enormous shaft that went almost straight up. It was about 16 degrees off vertical, and it was shaped like a sort of fat crescent moon, and he called it then the moon shaft.
And that's what you're looking for, this thing?
Yes.
Or you know where? Do you know where it is?
Yes.
I'm going to have to go to Slovakia with you. I imagine you get a lot of volunteers for that, don't you?
Oh, absolutely we do, yeah. But we just got the funds to go back. This will be my third trip, and this time taking the team, the SIU team. We hope to be able to finalize the project, get to it, and bring out enough evidence and documentation to prove it exists. And then there'll be no problem getting small teams of scientists back to it, so they can study this thing.
I guess the bottom line, though, Ted, is what do you do with the stuff if no one's taking it seriously? You've got 3,300 cases. You got a lot of solid evidence. You got files and eyewitnesses and samples that could be analyzed. But the larger mainstream guys don't seem to want to look at it. And I hate to keep beating that dead horse, but I mean, what do you do with this information to get it out?
Well, what I've always tried to do is get the any materials that I collected analyzed, and that's always been a major problem because the laboratories that can do the proper type of analysis are all affiliated with the government through large, big money projects. And just as Oak Ridge turned on the Delphos case, after that happened, of course, Alan and I looked at each other and said, well, did we really expect them to tell us anything significant? And why should they, you know? And so what we were doing, we were providing major laboratories with samples of really out of this world stuff. And we could get very little information from it. And that's one of the reasons that I decided the way to go was this Special Investigations Unit team. Because for 40 years, I went in behind the activity, picking up the breadcrumbs, the traces that they leave behind, but always after the fact. And
now you're blazing the trail yourself.
Well, and we're trying to insert ourselves into something that is either still there or is still active.
Ted, got to go. It's been, I'm killing myself for not having more time for you. Your website, ufophysical.com. We want to invite you back on the show, and I hope our listeners will go and check out your website. And I'd actually like to have you back as a regular contributor when you get back from Slovakia or anytime you got something interesting. Fair enough?
Pleasure. Sure.
All right. Thanks very much. It was great talking to you. We'll be right back, folks, with Nick Pope. Stick around on Coast to Coast AM.